All right, well, if you remember last week, we went through the chapter 11. It was after Saul had become king. And then Nahash, the Ammonite, threatened the men of Gabesh-Gilead to basically gouge out their right eye if they did surrender to him. That's what he was going to do. And anyway, long story short, this is where I think Saul had his first victory, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he defeated the Ammonites. And then the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul, they anointed him king once again. And this is where the story picks up, is after his victory over there against Nahash the Ammonite. Beginning of chapter 12, verse 1, it says, "Then Samuel said to all of Israel, 'Behold, I have listened to your voice and all that you said to me, and I have appointed a king over you. And now here is a king walking before you, but I am old and gray, and behold, my sons are with you. And I have walked before you from my youth even to this day. Here I am, bear witness against me before the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken, or whose donkey have I taken, or who have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed, or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind the eyes with it? I will restore it to you.' And they said, 'You have not defrauded us, or oppressed us, or taken anything from any man's hands.' And he said to them, 'The Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day that you have found nothing in my hand.' And they said, 'He is witness.'" Okay, before we go any further, now they've established Saul as being their king. And keep this in mind, Samuel was their judge, obviously, and Samuel was judging Israel, basically ruling Israel. And it was kind of like, I don't know if you want to call it a theocracy, where it was God was ruling his people through his judges, through his prophet. And the people didn't like that. They wanted to be like the other nations, and they had absolutely insisted upon having a king. And Samuel could see the folly in that, because they were rejecting God as being their king. And they wanted a, you know, flesh and blood king. And so Samuel says, okay, well, here he is. I mean, look at him. I mean, the guy was head and shoulders above everybody else. He was very young, strong, handsome. He's exactly what they wanted as far as the outward appearance was concerned. But now, basically what Samuel's doing is he's transferring over the leadership to Saul. And as he's doing this, I think it's kind of significant the way he does it, because here he is, he's an old man now, and he's challenging the people, saying, look, if I have defrauded anybody, if I've taken anything from anybody, if I've taken a bribe, if I've distorted justice, if I did anybody wrong in any way, shape, or form, I want you to come forward right now, and I'm going to make it right. And it says a lot about this guy, because in a sense, this guy has been serving the Lord since he was just a little kid. His mother dedicated him before he was even born. I mean, Hannah promised God that if he gave him a son, he would be a Nazarite, dedicated from basically his birth to God. So Samuel has lived his life in a fishbowl, so to speak. I mean, people knew him from when he was just a little kid serving God. And he served God all these years, and that's a pretty tough thing to do. I mean, especially if you look at, like, in our day and age, let's just say people right now, you know, all these people are throwing their hats in for, you know, to run for president. Well, we know what happens when they do that. I mean, usually what happens is you get into the, you know, these political races, and then, you know, everybody starts dredging up your past, right, to try to sling some kind of mud at you. I mean, I don't care whether you're Democrat or Republican or who you are. It's just going to happen. Well, they couldn't find anything to nail on Samuel. But I think it says a lot about the guy, because it says in that verse 3, "Here I am, bear witness against me before the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken, or whose donkey have I taken, or whom have I defrauded, of whom I have oppressed, or from whose hands have I taken a bribe?" You know, I don't think there's too many people that could say that in our political system today. I really don't. All right. Now, they don't call it bribes. They don't call it bribes. What do they call it? You know, the special interest money. It's the same thing as a bribe. That's all it is. These people will pervert what is doing the right thing as long as somebody can continue to grease their palms to get them reelected or get them more money in their coffers or whatever. But Samuel was the type of man, he says, okay, you know, if I've done anything wrong, then I'm going to make it right. And this isn't kind of reminds you of Zacchaeus in the New Testament, where, you know, he was a short man and he climbed a tree to see Jesus passing by. Jesus looked up at him and says, "Zacchaeus, come down. Today I must dine with you." So Zacchaeus scurried down from the tree and enthusiastically brought the Lord into his house. And the first thing Zacchaeus said to Jesus is, "Lord, if I've defrauded anybody, I'm going to pay him back fourfold." And Jesus said, "Hey, today salvation has come to this household," because here was a man who was not just going to give God lip service, but if he's wronged anybody, he was going to make it right fourfold over. And I think that's what people need to do. This whole concept of restitution has gone out the window. People just say, well, you know, I've asked God to forgive me. Well, what about the people that you've wronged? If you can make restitution, I think we have a moral obligation to do that. And that's what Samuel is basically saying here. If I defrauded you, or oppressed any, or taken anything from you of a man's hand, then I'll make it up to you. And anyway, verse 5 says, then he said to them, the Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day that you have found nothing in my hand. And they said, he is witness. Then Samuel said to the people, it is the Lord who appointed Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers up from the land of Egypt. So now take your stand, that I may plead with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous acts of the Lord, which he has did for you and for your fathers. When Jacob went into Egypt and your fathers cried out to the Lord, then the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt and settled them in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God, so he sold them into the hands of Sisera, the captain of the army of Hazor, and into the hands of the Philistines, and into the hands of the king of Moab, and they fought against them. And then they cried out to the Lord and said, we have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord, and have served the Baals and the Ashtaroth, but now deliver us from the hands of our enemies, and we will serve thee. Then the Lord sent Jerubbaal, or actually Gideon, and Bedan, and Jephthah, and Samuel, and delivered you from the hands of your enemies all around you, so that you lived in security. And when you saw that Naash, the king of the sons of Ammon, had came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us, although the Lord your God was your king. Now therefore, here is the king whom you have chosen, whom you have asked for, and behold, the Lord has set a king over you. You know, before we go further, too, you know, you see this constantly in Scripture. Moses did it. Joshua did it. Matter of fact, in the New Testament, Stephen did it. Paul did it. Time and time again, the men of God, what would they do when they were trying to address God's people? They would always go back and remind them what God had done in the past. All right, and that's what Samuel's doing now. He reaches all the way back to how God delivered them from Egypt and how he swore to their fathers that he was going to bless them with a great land. But then he tells them how time and time again, what did they do? They forsook God, and then God gave them over to their enemies. And then when the people were really hard-pressed, they had a change of heart, repented of their sins, turned back to God, and God raised up a deliverer and delivered them. But it seems like hardly a generation would go by before they slipped back in their old ways and forget God. And, you know, same old thing. Happens all over again. I mean, history keeps repeating itself. But what's interesting to me is, what does he do? He goes back and he recounts to them their past. And if you read the number of times, like if you get a concordance out and you read the number of times it uses the word remind them or remember, I mean, it's just dozens and dozens and dozens of times that God is constantly trying to get people to remember. You know, like Solomon says in Ecclesiastes, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come, you no longer enjoy living. And how many times have we given that admonition to remember, to remind us to do what? To stir up as a way of reminder. This is why it's so important, you know, that we get together for Bible or to read the Bible on your own, to study it, to study it, to study it. Why? Because, man, it's like trying to pour water into a sieve. I mean, how much do you remember? How much the last Sunday's sermon do you remember if you went to church? Do you get my point? I mean, it's really pathetic, isn't it, how we have such a wretched capacity when it comes to remembering things, especially the things of God. And when you consider the last figure that I read in a Time magazine is that the average American now spends 58 hours a week watching TV. It used to be 56, but now it's up another 2 hours.
It must not be working.
Well, all I'm saying is this, 58 hours a week watching TV, all right? I mean, if there's 48 hours in 2 days, well, then you're spending 2.5 solid days virtually every single week watching TV. That easily multiplies out to about 8 days in a month, and it goes out to like 3 months in a year, and you know, over a lifetime, it could add up to 20 years watching TV. How are we going to ever remember anything about God's Word if this is what we're going to end up doing? And see, the devil knows it. The devil knows that, hey, he just looks at us, he says, these maggots can't remember anything. They've got memories of a flash cube. All he has to do is just keep them entertained, keep them constantly, you know, on their minds on other things, and they are going to forget God. You know the old adage, out of sight, out of mind? That is so true when it comes to spiritual things. It's like the devil just knows, hey, man, get God out of their sight, get him out of their mind. Don't get them to open the Bible. Don't get them to go to a Bible study. If they go to church, just have them sit there and hem-haw around and just shine the pew with their rear end. But don't have them, you know, be listening to God's word and then take it into heart and put it into practice. This is why when you look at what Samuel's doing here, he's recapping to them their history, recapping to them what great things God did for them and where they made the mistake. Every time they turned around and forsook God, man, they just had one curse after another, after another, after another brought on. And look at this nation today, man. Are we in dire need of turning our lives around to God? I mean, it's so obvious. Anyway, picking up verse 13 again. It says, "Now therefore, here is the king whom you have chosen, whom you have asked for, and behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you will fear the Lord and serve him and listen to his voice and not rebel against the command of the Lord, then both you and your king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God." So, in other words, even though these people rejected God and wanting a king, God is still going to work through it. He's saying, okay, I'll give you a king, and here's the thing. If you just follow me, obey me, do what I tell you, you know, you're still going to be blessed. All right? That's basically what he's telling him. Verse 15, it says, "And if you will not listen to the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the command of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers." Now, look at that verse. I mean, it's easy to go over in one ear and out the other over our heads, but just apply it to our nation today. Look at it, it says, "And if you will not listen to the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the command of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers." Look at how God's hand is against us today. Well, when you read this here, God is basically saying, look, if you will follow me, I will still bless you. You know, even though you've rejected me as wanting your king, if you still obey me, I'm going to use your king and bless you. He says here in verse 16, he says, "Even now, take your stand and see the great things which the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call to the Lord that he may send thunder and rain, and then you will know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord by asking for yourselves a king." So Samuel called to the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. Then all the people said to Samuel, "Pray for your servants to the Lord your God, so that we may not die, for we have added to all of our sins this evil by asking for ourselves a king." And Samuel said to the people, "Do not fear. You have committed all this evil, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart." And look what happened. Here's a situation where Samuel's saying, okay, I'm going to prove to you that you have greatly sinned against the Lord. He says, isn't this the harvest season? In other words, it's basically, I guess what it is the winter's past, and it's not the rain season. And apparently there's a clear day, and then he says, God is going to bring rain upon you and thunder. And that's exactly what he did. Right there out of a, you know, clear blue sky, here comes all this rain and all this thunder and this lightning. And all of a sudden the people, you know, they get pretty scared. Look what it says here in verse 17. "Is this not the wheat season? Is this not the wheat harvest today? I will call to the Lord that he may send thunder and rain. And then you will know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord by asking yourself for a king." And isn't this what God does? He constantly is speaking to men through nature. I mean, it's like God has all kinds of sirens and bells and warnings that are going off from heaven, just warning men that we are in a collision course with judgment. And when these people seen this thunder and this lightning and this rain in the middle of, I don't know if it was summer or it was in the fall, but what's happened here is these people could see that this was a miraculous sign from God, that he was speaking to them through this. But in spite of that, what does God say to them? Look at that in verse 20. "And Samuel said to the people, 'Do not fear. You have committed all this evil, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart.'" It's like the same message, I think, can be applied to us today. In spite of all of our evil, in spite of all the wickedness that we have committed, all right, there's still that mercy that's being extended by God, just saying, look, if you just turn from your wicked ways. I mean, that's what we're told in Chronicles. "If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I will heal their land. All right? But how many of us are following God with all of our heart? I mean, that's the thing. If you look at it, it says, "But serve the Lord with all your heart." And then, you know, in spite of the fact that they've blown it by asking for a king and rejecting God, God's going to work through it anyway. He says, hey, if you just follow me, just obey me, just serve me, and not with half measures and not with a lukewarm, apathetic indifference, but with all your heart, yeah, I'm still going to bless you. And then in verse 21 it says, and you must not turn aside, for then you will go after futile things which cannot profit or deliver because they are futile. I mean, look at that. I mean, it says so much to me. It says, you must not turn aside, for then you would go after futile things. This doesn't seem like as a nation. We give God the time of day, but we got all the time for this futile stuff, this stuff that's just empty. It's vain. It's vanity. That's what it is. I mean, you know, it's pointless. So he's just saying, you know, it's not going to deliver you because they are futile. Verse 22, for the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name, because the Lord has been pleased to make you a people for himself. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you, but I will instruct you in the good and the right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth in all your heart, for consider that what great things that he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king will be swept away. Now look at this. I think this says a lot. It's very, very instructive. And like Paul says in the New Testament, all of this is given to us for our instruction, for our edification, for our example, for our reproof. Because look at that verse 23. He says, moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you. You know what it is? I mean, they asked Samuel to intercede for them on behalf of God because of their wickedness. But he says, hey, it would be sinful for him not to intercede, not to pray. And, you know, this is the one thing I always try to stress, is that, hey, man, we really do need to pray for one another. We need to pray for each other. I get the impression here that if you don't pray, if you cease praying for others, you know, it's a sin. If it's a sin of omission. And I especially feel this is especially true when it comes to your children. I'm constantly admonishing people, or, you know, saying, hey, man, you need to pray for your kids. You need to constantly be uphold them in prayer, constantly. You know, and every time I get an opportunity, I pray with, you know, for my kids. I pray for other people's kids, and, you know, just constantly uphold them before the Lord. Because look what they're up against today. It's just appalling what they have to deal with. I mean, it's just you wonder how anybody can be saved in a world that has so turned its back on God, so forsaken him, and so trampled underfoot his moral laws. I mean, it's really, really tough for kids today. And that's why I think that, hey, man, if parents don't pray for their kids and intercede for them earnestly, constantly, I think it's a sin of omission, because that's what's implied here. But, you know, he says in that verse 24, only fear the Lord and serve him in truth. There's a lot of people today who claim to serve God, but are they serving him in truth? Look at all the heresies. Look at all the false religions. Look at all the cults that are running around. I mean, if you're in a cult like the Jehovah's Witnesses, I mean, you're not serving him in truth, because everything's distorted. Or, you know, look at the Muslims. Are they serving God in truth? Killing people left and right, is that serving him in truth? No. Jesus said to the woman at the well, he says, God is looking for those who worship him in spirit and in truth. You got to have a correct knowledge and understanding of who he is, and a correct knowledge of his son, of his word, of salvation, and then worship him with all your heart. Worship him in spirit and in truth. That's what he's talking about here. Not giving God just simply lip service or head acknowledgement. He said in verse 24, only fear the Lord and serve him in truth and with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king will be swept away. How many times does the Bible give us that kind of that admonition, in a sense that, you know, it just simply says, hey, man, God said, if you do this, I'll do that. If you do that, I'll do this. I mean, if, in my opinion, is the biggest little word in the Bible. And that's what God is saying here. Look at that verse. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king will be swept away. You can apply this in this country. I want to read this again, because I can see the handwriting all over the wall. And I think even people who don't believe in God or don't believe in the Bible, or, you know, don't go to church, don't give a rat's behind about anything religious, I think that they can sense this. I really do. I deal with people day in and day out. I deal with hundreds of people, and I get the impression, you know, that a lot of people that I deal with, they have this sense that there's no good news out there. I mean, look at this. It says, but if you still do wickedly, both you and your king will be swept away. And I think there's that sense that people feel. You know, I don't care how optimistic they try to be or how upbeat they try to appear. They can sense there's something radically wrong in this world, in this country. And, you know, we're all just kind of like waiting for the other shoe to drop, so to speak. Because look what it's saying here. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king will be swept away. And I really believe that we're on our way out. There's no doubt in my mind about it. even though people think, well, you know, he's just Mr. Puddleglum, he's just a cynic, he's just a, you know, a pessimist or whatever. I'm just saying, hey, man, I'm just a realist. I just read the Bible, I look at history, I look at current events, and I could see a parallel that's so crystal clear, I don't see how people can miss it. Even the blind can see it if you have any discernment. Anybody have anyone to add or share to that that chapter 12? Anyway, this chapter 13, beginning with verse 1, it says, "And Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 32 years over Israel." Now, there's a real difficulty in this verse because the fact that in the translation, something has been dropped. As a matter of fact, in the King James Version, it says, "Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel." I think in the Modern Language Bible, it says, "By this time, Saul had reigned for 1 year, and when Saul had been king over Israel, 2 years." And the Living Bible says, "By this time, Saul had reigned for 1 year. In the second year of his reign, he selected 3,000 special troops, etc." And in the Revised Standard, it says, "And Saul was," and they just got dot, 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 "years old when he began to reign." Any other translations that are different from that? The reason why it's so different and it's so ambiguous is because the number has been lost. The number has been dropped. As a matter of fact, there's a footnote that says the number is lacking in Hebrew. It's like there's something that's been lost in antiquity as far as the year, all right? So the best we could put together, I mean, in some of these Bibles, like mine says, Saul was 40 years old. I don't believe he was 40 years old. I believe that he was probably more in his 30s or late 20s. That says 30? See, it's not contradiction here, all right? This is something that's been lost as far as the copyist is concerned. But if you go back to the 13th chapter of the book of Acts, when Paul is preaching in Antioch, he goes through and he starts recapping some of the history of Israel, just like Samuel was doing. And he said that Saul reigned for 40 years. All right? That's what Paul said. So I think that as much as I could piece together from other portions of Scripture, I get the impression that he was around 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned for 40 years. All right? And anyway, in verse 2, it says, "Now Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel, of which 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in the hill country of Bethel, while 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah of Benjamin. But he sent away the rest of the people, each to his tent." Now, here's the thing. You got to kind of piece this all together, because maybe Saul was a little bit older, but I think he was probably around 30. He probably, at this particular time in his life, is mid-40s. Well, his son, Jonathan, is probably early 20s or so. Well, he's ruling and reigning with his father. And his father, what he's done is he's got 3,000 men that he's got for himself and 1,000 men with Jonathan. That's basically how he split up his army. That's what it's talking about in this verse 2. It says, while there were 1,000 men were with Jonathan at Gibeah of Benjamin, but he sent away the rest of the people east to his tent. In other words, he was always commanding an army around him of 3,000 men and Jonathan 1,000 men. But whenever there was a crisis situation, then they'd call up all the reserves, in other words, all the rest of the men of Israel to fight. And then in verse 3 it says, "And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that were in Gibeah, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, Let the Hebrews hear. And all of Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines, and the people were then summoned to Saul at Gilgal." Now, you know, if you look at this map up here, it says in this verse 3, "And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that were in Geba." Now, I don't know if you can see it on the map, but I think it's right up here, Geba. Look at that. If that's the place, I mean, it's right in the heart of Manasseh. And what does that say to you? If all the Philistine cities are down here along the coast, the Philistines were right in the very heart of Israel. And you make that spiritual application today, we are dealing with spiritual Philistines. Today, they're all over the place. Look at the inroads that the Philistines have made in this country and into the church. We are being defeated in this culture war. Well, you know, that's a spiritual application you can make. But anyway, what happened is that Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was at Gibeah, or Geba rather, and the Philistines heard it. And then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." Well, I get the impression now you've got to follow this guy's character, Saul, because when we first were introduced to him, he seemed like a very, very humble man who was very, very reluctant to lead and very, very, you know, he just didn't want to take on the reins of leadership, all right? He showed himself to have some good leadership qualities, but more and more you begin to see something in a guy that I think you could detect his downfall. Okay, and you can always apply it to the fact that old saying, power corrupts, total power corrupts totally. And you can see it in this situation because here Jonathan smites the Philistines and Saul blows the trumpet. And what does he do? Apparently he takes credit for that. Because look at that verse 4, and all of Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines. Well, it was his son that did it, but apparently he got the credit, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines, and the people were summoned to Saul at Gilgal. In verse 5, it says, now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sands which is on the seashore in abundance. And they came up and camped at Michmash, east of Beth-Haven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves, in the thickets and cliffs and in cellars and in pits. Also some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead. But as for Saul, he was still at Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. And he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offering. And he offered the burnt offering. And it came about as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, that behold, Samuel came, and Samuel went out to meet him and to greet him. But Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, therefore I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. And Samuel said to Saul, you have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he has commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as a ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord had commanded you. Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the men who were present with him, about 600 men. Now Saul and his son Jonathan and the people who were present with them were staying at Geba of Benjamin, while the Philistines camped at Michmash. Now, before we go any further, here's a situation where Saul was given specific instructions. All right, he's hard pressed, but he's being tested, and his faith is being tested, isn't it? Here, look at this situation. Saul has 3,000 men with him. Jonathan has 1,000 men. All right, and now they're in such a situation where you look at what the Philistines have. In that verse 5, the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sands which are on the seashore in abundance. And they came up and encamped at Michmash, east of Beth-Haven. So, I mean, Saul's army far outnumbered. There's no question about it. I mean, there's just no contest here. And, you know, Saul's army sees this, and what are they doing? They're all scattering. He goes from 3,000 men to 600 men. And if you throw in Jonathan's men, they would have gone from 4,000 to 600 men. They're scattering. I mean, I guess when nightfall came, a lot of them just deserted. They went AWOL. They figured, hey, man, there's no way we can win this. But look what happens here. Look at that verse 8. Now he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gibeah, to Gilgal, rather, and the people were scattering from him. All right, now, he was given specific instructions. When Samuel told him, wait there 7 days, when I get there, I'm going to offer the sacrifice unto God, and I'm going to tell you what to do. All right, this is what Samuel was going to do. He was basically going to give him military strategy after sacrificing the Lord. But look at how God made him wait. He was waiting right up to the last minute, and then he blows it. If he would have just waited probably another half an hour or even less than that, because it says as soon as he did it, here comes Samuel. Waiting is the most difficult thing there is in so many different ways. I mean, we're all waiting for something, aren't we? I don't care what it is. People are waiting for what? They're either waiting to retire, or they're waiting for their ship to come in some way, shape, or form. They're waiting to get married. They're waiting, you know, to get out of school. They're waiting to graduate. They're waiting to start a career. Waiting for this. Waiting. I mean, we're all waiting for something, aren't we? But you look at it, and waiting can be very, very, very difficult, especially when it comes to waiting on God. This is the way that God will stretch our faith time and time and time again. Look at how he stretched Abraham's faith. You know, Abraham came out of Babylon, of Ur, came out of there when he was 75 years old. Now, how long did he have to wait before he did the promise of a son? He waited 25 years. But you see, even in the midst of that waiting, I think he waited like 14 years, and then his wife got in the act. He figured, well, where's God in this? We misunderstood him. We have to help God out. So Sarah gave Abraham her handmaid, said, well, I'll have a kid through her. And she ended up having Ishmael, and Ishmael became the father of the Arabs. And, you know, look at this mess that's been created now, because he didn't wait long enough. And how many people fall into that category when they just don't wait upon God? And it's so hard to do, because a lot of times we will want to push and force and shove to put things the way we want them, just like Saul did. If he would have waited another 10 minutes, it looks like, 20 minutes, I mean, he just figured, hey, Samuel's not here, everybody's deserting me, I got to offer this sacrifice, and yet it was a total disobedience to what God had said. No one wants to offer sacrifice but the priest. And here Saul is. He's a king, but he's not a Levite. He's not from a priestly tribe. He's from the tribe of Benjamin. And he takes this upon himself. And what happens is that he gives this excuse to Samuel. But what Samuel said to him? Because I think it's very instructive. In that verse 13, Samuel said to Saul, you have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom forever. You know, it says a lot to us. Sometimes we just have to continue to wait and obey. It's just to wait and obey, and it's not an easy thing to do. But by waiting, I think it really stretches our faith. I think if Saul, if he would have really stuck to his guns and says, hey, I don't care if every one of you could desert me, we're going to wait here and we're going to do this, because God is going to get the victory here. Because if he had that kind of faith, he would have a tremendous victory. Because you know, not only would he have been obedient to God, but then Samuel would have told him what he needed to do, and God was going to give him the victory. But anyway, with that verse 15, then Samuel rose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. Now Saul and his son Jonathan and the people who were present with them were staying at Geba of Benjamin, while the Philistines camped at Michmash. And the raiders came from the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned towards Ophrah to the land of Sheol, and another company turned towards Beth Horon, and another company turned towards the border which overlooks the valley of Zeboim, towards the wilderness. Now no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, least the Hebrews make swords or spears. So all of Israel went down to the Philistines, each to sharpen his plowshare, or his mattocks, his axe and his goad. Whenever they had to sharpen the edge of the goads of the mattocks or the forks and of the axes to fix the goad points. So it came about on that day of battle that neither the sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul or Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and his son Jonathan. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. Now, this gives you a little insight of what's going on here, is because of Saul's entire army, I guess him and his son are the only ones that really have swords. The rest of them have nothing more than farming implements to go to war with. I mean, this shows you how these Philistines have put them in such dire straits. It's not that the Hebrews didn't know how to be blacksmith. It's just that the Philistines were ruling over them, and they would not permit any blacksmiths to be found in Israel. And if a person needed to buy a farming implement or had to go to a blacksmith, they had to go to the Philistines to get it. And when I read this, I can't help but make the comparison. I hope it's not a real stretch or a mental leap, but, you know, look at the situation that we have, for example, in our schools today. It's being run by modern-day Philistines, and these modern-day Philistines will not allow creationists or creationism to be taught in our schools. They will not allow it. They're like the Philistines, not allowing blacksmiths. They will not allow even the other side to be presented. It's the same thing with what happened here. The Philistines would not allow them to have any kind of blacksmith, because they knew that, hey, man, you arm these people, and then we're liable to lose our reign over them, right? I mean, like I said, I don't want to make that much of a mental leap, but I certainly can see the spiritual significance of it, because, like I said, we're dealing with modern-day Philistines today. They're all over the place, and they've made tremendous inroads in this country. Anybody have anything you want to add or share to that?
Tom, I did have one question. On verse 13, is that like going to change history completely?
What's that?
If Saul would have, you know, it says, which he commanded you, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever.
Yeah. In other words,
history could have been totally different if
been patient. Oh, definitely. Definitely. It could have been. In other words, his throne would have been established through his son Jonathan and then through his descendants and his. It was this act of disobedience that basically put an end to his dynasty, which really wasn't much of a dynasty. It just started with him, all right? But if he had been obedient to God, it would have been passed on from his sons from generation to generation. That's what he was saying.
It did say he did wait. He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel. So it's like, must have the hour to that day.
No, here's the thing. Samuel said, wait 7 days until I come there. So Samuel basically said, I'm going to be there on the seventh day. Now, I'm sure he didn't give him a time. He just said, I'm going to be there on the seventh day. All right? Well, it was the seventh day.
And the point is, you don't offer sacrifice unless you're a priest.
Right. Right. I mean, obviously, that's the point, too. But I'm just simply saying he pushed himself. He said he forced himself to do this. Well, it was a direct violation of what God had set forth in the Mosaic law, that only a descendant of Aaron could act as a priest. And it had to come from the tribe of Levi. And Saul, here he was, a king, feeling like, well, you know, I'm anointed, too. So, you know, I can take on this position as priest. And what he really did was put an end to his own, you know, dynasty, in a sense, because of his disobedience.
Knew if he did this and that's what God would do, or did God tell him? Because it's really specific here. So, well, what have you done? Oh, you did that. That's what's going to happen to your kingdom. And so it's like he already knew.
Well, see, Samuel's a prophet. We're going to read on a little bit more, especially when we get into reading about David. God just talks to Samuel, but nobody hears him but Samuel, all right? Especially when Samuel starts anointing David. What Samuel does is have all the sons of Jesse, and Jesse has 8 sons. He has the 7 of them stand up, and David's missing. Anyway, Samuel goes to looks at the first guy, and he looked like he'd be a really good king because physically he looked great. But Samuel looks at him, and God says, hey, man, he's not the one. He says, man judges by outward appearance, but God judges by the heart. In other words, nobody heard God speaking to Samuel, but Samuel was hearing God's voice speak to him. The same thing you could apply here, all right? When Samuel saw that Saul had overstepped his bounds, he didn't wait. He forced himself upon the priesthood. He did this in direct violation of God's specific commands. Then when Samuel said this to Saul in verses 13 and 14 about his kingdom, it was that God was just told him exactly what was going to happen. So he's sitting there as a prophet saying this. I don't think it was a situation where Samuel already knew all this ahead of time. He just, at that moment, God spoke to him. And this is what he's, you know, this is the bad news that he got. Anyway, like I said, you look at this, we are hard-pressed today as far as the Philistines that we have to deal with today, the spiritual Philistines, the modern-day Philistines, all right? I mean, they're all over the place, and we are overrun, and they are deep in the heart of the church in our country. And I think the few people that are left that are just digging in their heels and trying to serve God, and trying to obey Him and follow Him, you know, it's tough. It really is. I mean, every day for me, it's really, really tough to do this. But what have we told in Timothy, where Paul says, know for sure that in the last days, difficult times will come. He said difficult times will come because men are going to be lovers of self and lovers of pleasure, and they'll be boastful and reckless and haters of God and haters of good and hate, you know, all these different things we have to contend with because we're being overrun by modern-day Philistines in the spiritual sense. Anybody have anyone want to add or share?